Hi, this is Kalina.
And this is Gabe.
Welcome to
Bigger Than Love.
Hello, welcome to our podcast, Bigger Than Love. My name's Kalina.
And I'm Gabe.
What's been going on in your world today, Gabe?
Oh, a whole lot of living. Just a human being human.
Human being human.
Mm-hmm.
I feel you. In fact, we're going to talk about humans being humans today on the podcast. So I have a question. Why does being around family make even the most grounded person lose their cool? Today is kind of a pre-holiday episode where we're going to explore why our calm feels so fragile when we're back in the swirl of family dynamics. The old roles, the subtle triggers, and the well-meaning comments that land like arrows. And through the lens of yoga philosophy and a little nervous system science, we're going to unpack how our bodies remember early experiences of safety and stress and why certain patterns resurface around the people who know us the best. And most of the time, those people are the ones that push our buttons the hardest. So as the holidays approach, this conversation is going to invite all of us to bring our yoga off the mat and into the family room, if you will. I've been thinking about this a lot this week because I'm going to see my family this weekend. And when we go home or even just pick up the phone, something ancient in us wakes up. It's not just the conversation that's happening now. It's the echo of a thousand moments that came before. And family, at least in my opinion, has this uncanny way of pressing on the oldest buttons in our body and our nervous system, the ones wired long before we even knew what self-regulation meant. You can spend years cultivating breathwork, mindfulness, boundaries, therapy, yoga, all the above, and still one familiar tone or offhand comment can send your body back into that early version of yourself. The one who wanted to feel seen, safe, right. And I'm super happy because yoga has given me the language for this. This reflection on old patterns, grooves carved by repetition, both beautiful and sometimes limiting. And family is where many of those grooves were first made. And so when we return home, we're not just sitting with our parents or our siblings, we're actually sitting with our history, this giant suitcase full of things. I know for me, my practice isn't about staying perfectly calm. It's about staying awake inside reactivity because I can be really reactive. Taking a breath between a trigger and a response and choosing curiosity instead of collapse and remembering that compassion doesn't mean to erase myself and boundaries don't mean disconnection. Gabe, does this sound interesting to you?
It's very interesting, and I can't imagine that this episode wouldn't touch upon something for everyone.
Well, I hope so. I've had a couple people recently, as the holidays approach, asking for an episode about this topic. So I thought we could talk about it. So I wrote this down on my notes because family is where our nervous system was built. And what does that mean? I think about it in the context of many of the people that listen to this podcast, including me and you. Before we ever rolled out a yoga mat, our first practice space was our family system. Long before we could name emotions or take deep breaths on purpose, our bodies were learning. Through every interaction, what safety felt like. Our parents' tone of voice, the rhythm of mornings, the way conflict rose and resolved or didn't resolve. All of this sculpted the foundation of our nervous system. And these early experiences taught us what to expect from connection. Was it warm and stable or unpredictable or sharp? Did repair follow rupture or did silence swallow everything? And these patterns are stored not in our thoughts, but in our tissues, actually in the very thing that feels like our body, in the subtle language of our muscle tone, our breathing rhythms, and even our heart rate. When you go home, you're not just entering a physical space, you're actually stepping into an emotional climate that your body still recognizes, no matter how much time has passed. The smell of certain food or the creak of the hallway floor if you're going home to the house you grew up in. Even the way someone sighs at the table, they act like little passwords that unlocked our neural pathways in our brain. And suddenly your adult consciousness, the one that teaches yoga and sets boundaries and meditates and leads classes, is sharing a room with the younger version of myself who once sometimes froze or fawned or fought really hard to feel safe. And in poly vagal terms. It's called neuroception, the body's unconscious scanning for cues of safety or danger. And it happens way before thought. Your logical mind might know that you're fine, that you're safe. Your body might register familiar tones or postures as threat signals simply because they used to be. Maybe at some point in your life, that was a sign that something wasn't okay. I believe one of the underlying reasons, I know for myself, that I fell in love with the practice of yoga so much is because it helps bring awareness to that gap, that space between the past and the present, between reaction and response. And every time we take a breath consciously in the face of old stimuli, we're offering our nervous system an update. In fact, I've even caught myself saying to myself, this moment is different. I have the tools now. I can stay here. Over time, that regulation becomes not perfection or eternal calm, but the ability to notice when our inner 5-year-old has taken the wheel and gently guide him or her back towards presence. And it's yoga in its rawest form, union between who we were and who we're becoming and who we are right now. It's a beautiful opportunity if you choose to see it that way. I have an example, and I'm sure you do too, Gabe. The biggest thing for me is when I'm around, for instance, my mom, I tend to revert back to like a younger version of myself where like I want my mom to stroke my hair or like, you know, have her hold my hand or like she does this thing where she kind of like rubs your arm, like the skin on your arm. And it's very disarming. Like it brings me back to like feeling very 5-year-old me. And when I feel that way around my mom, I'll instantaneously want to like eat candy or like go for ice cream. Something that my mom and I used to do, especially if I was upset, my mom would take me to Dairy Queen and get a Blizzard.
A Blizzard.
I can think of something that I've seen happen in your family dynamic that doesn't happen here in our family dynamic as frequently, which is when you're around your dad, you two have your own pun language. Everything becomes a pun and I don't understand what y'all are talking about. And you have a lot of inside jokes and you kind of turn in, from my point of view, kind of what I would imagine 12-year-old Gabe was like.
For sure.
Yeah.
My dad is like a giant 12-year-old.
You're both 12-year-olds together.
Yeah, for sure.
All of this is to say that all the roles in our family kind of get frozen in time. Every family is a kind of ecosystem, and ecosystems need balance. So often, unconsciously, families assign roles to maintain stability. The responsible one, that was me. The emotional one, the peacemaker, the rebel, the clown, or I don't know if you had a title in your family, but probably the guy that moved to California is the rock star.
Oh, yeah, I guess so, huh?
That's definitely a label, a role. And these roles help the system function, but they can also trap us in outdated versions of ourselves. Even as we evolve, the family story tends to lag behind. You might have done like years of therapy or learned to communicate clearly or built a life grounded in self-awareness. And yet at the dinner table, you're still the sensitive one or the one who overreacts or the one who always fixes things. And I know for me, that definitely shows up. I am definitely pegged as the dramatic one in my family. And I'm not to say that that's not true, because everyone who's listening to this podcast probably would say, oh yeah, Kalina can be dramatic. Some people might even take my class because of the theatrical side of myself. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that an updated version of me is I know when not to be dramatic now, where when I was younger, I did not know. I didn't have a filter.
Mine is just knowing when to keep my mouth shut. And I don't always get it right, but definitely better now than when I was coming up.
When you were a kid, did you mouth off a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have an example?
Well, I mean, the earliest one is my catchphrase, I not.
Oh, yeah, I not.
Yeah. Yeah, which would just be like to anything when someone would ask me to do something, specifically my parents, I'd be like, and I wouldn't be snarky about it, but I'd just be like, I not.
And would you walk off or would you just say I not and just stand there and stare?
Who knows? Probably both.
You're kind of still a little I not, to be honest with you.
Yeah, at least I'm aware of it now.
You don't say it. You can see it in your face. You still have an I not face.
I'm just living that I not life.
Totally. So anyway, all of those old labels act like invisible scripts, and everyone unconsciously plays their part to keep the family play running the way it always has. And it doesn't even have to be rehearsed. For sure, it's going to happen. And when others don't update their view of you, your system feels it, not just as frustration, but as being invisible almost. There's this internal protest. I know for myself, you can't see who I am now, but family memory is sticky, especially if you are in a family where you moved away from home, let's say like right after high school. and you haven't been home for 20 plus years, to them, you're not just who you are today. You are the accumulation of every age you've ever been. And that's why small comments can sting so deeply. It's really about what's happening on the surface. The argument about the mashed potatoes or the holiday plans is really a longing to be witnessed accurately, to be met as the current version of yourself, not the child they once knew or the role you once filled to keep peace in your family dynamic. And in yogic language, this dynamic lives in our past stories, these deep grooves of conditioning formed by repetition. Family interactions are like gravity that pull us back into these grooves before we even realize that we've slipped in. And the practice isn't to fight the pull, but to notice it, to feel the moment your shoulders start to tense or you start to hold your breath or tighten your jaw and recognize it as, ah, I know this pattern. I've been here before. That moment of awareness is yoga. That sacred pause between being unconsciously cast in an old role and consciously choosing a new one. And each breath, each small act of awareness slowly reshapes the groove, and you start to bring a presence where there used to be performance, and you start to belong to yourself again. And I think a lot about this, and obviously the only experience I've ever had, which is the one that I've lived, that feeling through time and space to start to belong to yourself is like such a rite of passage of adulthood, you know, to be like, oh my gosh, I'm my own person. And for some, maybe it happens early on in their life, maybe when they go to college or something like that. For me, I don't think I really started to feel that way until I was in my 30s, where I really felt like I belonged to myself and that I was making decisions that at one time I only dreamed I would make for myself. And they're so different than the decisions that I think maybe my mom or my dad or really anyone in my family would make for me and or for themselves. Mm-hmm. You said this was a big one for you.
It's a daily practice for me to remind myself and to implement the idea that, or the mantra rather, that I am entirely up to me.
I like that. I think all of this is important because we care a lot. If we didn't care, we wouldn't get so activated. It's easy to stay calm with strangers. Their opinions don't live in our cells. Obviously, I care about my students' experiences, but like their opinions of me don't carry as much weight as my mom's or yours. But with family, like love and history are woven together, and that mix creates intensity. And the deeper the bond, the deeper the potential for both joy, but also for reactivity. Mm-hmm. And caring means our hearts are open. But open hearts are really tender territory, and around family, love and pain sit right next to each other, like on a love seat, like a very small love seat. You want to be seen and you want to be respected and you want to understood. At least, I mean, I'm speaking for myself. I assume everyone's like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Not just for what you do as your job, but for who you choose to be, like who you are. And when that doesn't happen, even small things can land like a blow. The body reacts before the mind can interrupt it. And for me, that shows up. If I feel like I'm not being seen for who I really am, I turn into Mrs. Fix-It, where like I'm like, okay, well, since you don't see me for him, I'm about to fix this whole situation and you're going to have nothing but respect for me. Almost like I have to like force respect. I'm going to show you. The body reacts before the mind can interrupt. A tightening in the chest or the heat behind the eyes, a flush of adrenaline. And that's not drama. That's attachment physiology. I mentioned earlier polyvagal theory. From the polyvagal perspective, our nervous systems are wired for connection as survival. It's not that we just want connection. I see this a lot in the yoga world where someone's decided to open up a yoga studio and they've hired somebody to help them with their business plan. They pick 5 words that embody what it is they're trying to achieve at their yoga studio. And connection is always one of the words. Like out of all the yoga studios I've ever worked at all the places I've ever been, connection is a big buzzword. And I just think that's a given. Of course we want connection. That's how we survive. Without connection, what's the point, really? We depend on attunement, that back and forth of being seen and soothed, to regulate. All of us do. And so when someone we love misreads or dismisses us, it doesn't just feel bad emotionally. It actually disrupts our physiological sense of safety. And the heart rate speeds up, the breathing shortens, and we slip into protection mode. And many of you have heard fight, flight, freeze, fawn. love turns to defense, not because we're failing at calm. I don't want anyone to think that they're failing at calm, but it's happening because our system is doing its job to protect what matters most. And yoga gives us a framework for this tenderness called the bhakti path in yoga, the yoga of devotion. And this yoga of devotion reminds us that love is not meant to be smooth. Mm. It's actually meant to be a teacher. To love fully is to risk vulnerability, to stand in the fire of a relationship without shutting down or running away. I think this is such a beautiful thing. And I know, Gabe, in our relationship, and you could speak to this too, like, you've been my greatest teacher, but also my biggest source of love and connection in my personal life. I think the reason why I love you so deeply is because we've been through the fire multiple times. And through that experience, you really, really start to feel how strong devotion can be and what a teacher it can be. I know some of my greatest teachers have been people in my lives, whether family, teachers, friends, loved ones, who've challenged this idea of like what love is. Sometimes it's like tough love.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard it said before that love and truth are interchangeable. Mm-hmm. And just like so many things in life, my experience is it's easy to subscribe to these ideas when they're seemingly going your way. But then in that way, you're kind of cherry picking. Can you subscribe to whatever it is you believe in, even when it's a reflection of something that's crunchy or not ideal?
I think so much of love and connection is also when we feel a deep connection to someone else. It's also because they maybe embody something that we really want. And that's another way to look at it as a teaching thing. I know, at least I choose to look at it that way. Like when I think of, I use you an example because you're a safe example because you're right here and you give me permission to use you as an example. One of the things that I love and admire about you is your ability to basically talk to anyone, like anyone, insert human, and you're able to start a conversation, have a full-blown conversation, and by the end of the conversation, you're best friends with this person. Like, you know more about them than probably their own parents. And it's something I really love about you. You're the king of small talk.
Totally.
But at the same time, it's something that drives me crazy about you, especially like when we're in a hurry or like I'm ready to like leave the grocery store and you've made friends with an employee that works at the store you've made friends with and you're trying to invite him over for dinner or whatever you're doing. It's true though.
Is making a joke. I never invited an employee from the grocery store for dinner.
No, but like you totally make friends with people. I'll be like outside waiting in the car and you're still inside talking to someone. So it's like, it's kind of, I mean, it's an uncharged example of how you can love something and also like be aggravated by it in someone else because you don't have that. Like, you don't have that. It's like a teacher. It's a teachable moment. I mean, of course, I could give some more charged examples.
I to you as well.
No.
You have a really unique way of synthesizing an idea or an emotion or an observation into words simultaneously. A big thing that comes up in recording music is called latency, which is like the inherent time between when a sound is made and when it's recorded on a computer. And it's like your latency is unbelievably low. There's no way that it can be zero because it's going from an instrument to the computer. But your latency between an observation of whatever it is, of self, of someone else, me, and offering that observation in words is unreal.
But also annoying. I was waiting for the but.
No, I mean, yeah, not annoying. I mean, it's equal parts inspiring and intimidating at times.
I'm not great with small talk, unless it's about like anatomy or something
like that.
Well,
that's why we go. That's why we go together, because it's like I got totally. Small talk, you got big talk, and then together we have a podcast.
Ahimsa teaches that care belongs and begins within. Like, we can't offer peace if we continually abandon ourselves in the name of harmony or in the name of like making sure everyone's happy. And Santosha invites us to rest in this imperfection of love and to stop grasping for idealized connection and soften into what is. And when we approach family with this lens of Ahimsa and Santosha, like, we can start to see that our reactivity isn't a sign of failure. It's evidence of attachment, of care, and of our own humanity and our own ability to love. the work isn't to erase emotions, but to meet it with awareness and to pause mid-swell, maybe to whisper to ourselves, this surge means I care. Let me breathe through it. And that's the yoga of relationships, staying open in the presence of what matters most, even when it's uncomfortable. And love isn't calm by nature. It really stirs and exposes and burns and refines us again and again and again until we learn to keep our hearts open in the storm. I was thinking a lot this week, and I think I even mentioned it to you the other day, that the idea of boundaries kind of feel a lot of times for many of us un-yogic, and why that is. And for many of us who are steeped in yoga, spirituality, or healing work of any sorts, boundaries can feel sometimes like the opposite of love. We've been taught to be patient and compassionate. I mean, I don't know how many times a week I talk about compassion. Mm-hmm. To be forgiving and to see the divine in everyone, to see the light in everyone. To breathe through discomfort, to quote unquote stay open, is something you hear in almost like every class. So when we feel the need to draw a line or to say no or to step back, something inside us can whisper, isn't that selfish? Isn't that unspiritual? But here's the paradox. And again, I was thinking about this a lot this week. Without boundaries, compassion will collapse at some point. You'll just have compassion fatigue. Mm-hmm. And when we are overextended or we stop offering care and start leaking energy, when we allow constant overstepping, resentment replaces love most often. And what we call peacemaking is often nervous system appeasement, like a way to stay safe by minimizing conflict. And that yogic quality of ahimsa, or that non-harming, applies inward as much as it does outward. And to honor the peace of others, we must also protect peace within ourselves. And from a nervous system perspective, a boundary doesn't always have to be a wall. It can be a regulation tool. It defines the distance at which connection can remain safe. And too close, we might disconnect. Healthy boundaries allow our system to stay in that ventral vagal engagement, that zone of connection and grounded presence. They can say, let's stay in relationship without losing the shape of who we are. And when we don't assert boundaries, the body will start to take over. The tension you feel in your jaw or the knot in your stomach is often the body's way of setting a boundary. Your voice hasn't spoken yet. Your body's going to tell you, that doesn't feel right. That feels mm-hmm. off. That doesn't mm-hmm. feel like me. And over time, that unspoken no turns into burnout and to illness or passive withdrawal, which is my favorite. I don't mean to do it, but it's something I'm totally aware that I do if I don't set boundaries, and the body keeps the boundary for you at all costs. For some people, that might look like staying at home and like not wanting to go out. Or like I said, you might get sick. And I've even heard people say, like, if I don't start taking it easy, my body's going to make mm-hmm. that decision for me, as another way of thinking of it. In yogic philosophy, this balance lives in the intersection of that ahimsa and satya, non-harming, and also satya meaning truth. And ahimsa says, don't cause pain. And satya says, be real. Don't cause pain, but let's be real. And without truth, non-harming becomes repression. And without compassion, truth becomes cruel. And boundaries are where these two practices can meet. And the honest edges where love can stay alive. One of the things I like to say a lot, especially when I teach yamas and niyamas and I talk about truth, is like the truth is not always easy, but it can always be kind. A lot of people are afraid of truth because often truth might feel ugly, or like it might hurt someone's feelings, or maybe even hurt your feelings, but it doesn't have to. When you set a boundary with family, for instance, since this is what the underlying topic today is, when you say, I'm not available for that conversation right now, or I love you, but I'm going to step outside and take a breath, you're not being cold or un-yogic. You're practicing advanced asana, advanced practice, maintaining your inner alignment and emotional gravity so that you can show up. If you think of the boundary like a posture, because so many of the people, including ourselves who listen to the podcast, do a lot of yoga postures. So you think of a boundary like a posture, you find your ease, you engage your core, you lengthen through the spine, and you breathe, and you don't collapse or overreach. You adjust when your balance wobbles. The pose is never static. It's a living relationship between strength and softness. It's only static if someone takes a picture of you doing it. Boundaries are like that too. That's what relational yoga looks like off the mat, for instance. Boundaries aren't barriers to connection. They're actually the scaffolding that allows real intimacy to exist. And without them, we lose the ability to stay honest. And honesty is the foundation of love. I used to have a teacher that used to say, sometimes no is the most powerful mantra. Sometimes no is the most powerful mantra. I know everybody's probably seen those signs that says no is a complete sentence.
This is true.
So I've talked about ahimsa and satya, truth. I also want to point out that yoga calls svadhyaya, or self-study through relationship to you and family, is our most advanced training ground. So all my advanced yogis out here listening to the podcast, family mirrors our inner work. So family is the most precise mirror we have. It's not a gentle, softly lit mirror, but the kind that reflects every pore, every unhealed corner of our being, every crevice, every dimple, everything. Or as my grandmother used to say, when you wore tight clothes, I can see your credit card number through that. Family is that mirror, and it can be uncomfortable and intimate and profoundly intrusive. Yoga calls this process svadhyaya, or self-study. It's a practice of observing our patterns with curiosity rather than judgment. And nowhere does that practice get tested more than in the presence of our family. Because family does not just trigger us, they reveal us on a deep, deep level. And every interaction becomes a reflection of something within. That sibling who always interrupts, a mirror for the place where you still feel unheard, the parent who criticizes your choices, a reflection of the inner voice that still doubts your worth, the family member who withdraws, a reminder of your own instinct to retreat when things get tense. And it's not about blame, it's about reflection. Family dynamics really illuminate what's still tender, what's still reactive, what's still asking to be integrated into your life currently. And they show us the places where compassion has yet to take root towards others and towards ourselves. From the nervous system lens that we've spoke about a little bit on this episode, family mirrors our regulation patterns too. The anxious parent may evoke your fawn response. The loud sibling may activate your fight response. Stoic silence of an elder might pull you toward a freeze. But each of these reactions is a doorway, an invitation to notice how your body organizes around belonging and protection. Because the body just doesn't lie. It tells you where love meets fear. And yoga invites you and me and us to listen, to feel contraction and expansion, or push and pull, without collapsing into a story. Each breath is an act of witnessing, a way of saying, I see what's happening inside me and I'm willing to stay present with it. I think family mirrors can be hard to face because they collapse the distance between our practice and our personhood, as I like to think of it. You can't hide behind a mantra when your mom's tone of voice makes your stomach twist or makes you want to punch a wall. At least in my experience of practicing and teaching for over half of my life, I wish I could report to everyone listening, including myself, that a mantra, just a peace mantra, was going to...
It was enough.
Yeah, that it was enough. It's a start. It's definitely a start. All of this is also what makes this so sacred. The practice becomes real and lived and embodied. And every time you notice a trigger and choose to breathe, overreact, every time you soften instead of shutting down, you do rewrite a piece of your family lineage if you choose to see it that way. You interrupt an old cycle, not by forcing others to change, but by changing how you meet them. That's a quiet revolution. And that's yoga as relational practice in real time. Something that I like to try to tell myself when I'm with my family, something that rises like irritation or sadness or defensiveness, instead of asking what's wrong with them, I do try to ask, what are they showing me? Not as self-blame, but as self-inquiry and as an invitation to see myself more clearly and love myself more fully. Because back in the day, before I had the tools that I have now, I would just blame everyone. But it didn't really fix the way that I felt about myself. I think that flipping the conversation and being around people that perhaps trigger you quicker is a true practice of that svadhyaya, of that self-study, not just self-study for the sake of improvement, but self-intimacy for the sake of liberation, to be free from whatever story has been storing your whole life, you know, life be lifing. There is an opportunity to take svadhyaya as that path to freedom. One of the things that makes this challenging, and I kind of said this at the beginning of the episode, is that the nervous systems, if you will, talk to each other long before words do. When you walk into a room, for example, your body instantly begins reading the space. Posture, tone, micro expressions on people's faces, the pace of breathing. It's really ancient, invisible communication that we all do. And you don't decide to do it. Your body just knows. And this is what's called co-regulation. right? And the biological dance that lets us borrow steadiness from one another. It's why certain people, I don't know if you've ever been around someone that immediately, it could be a stranger, it could be someone you just met, but there's something about their presence and that co-regulation that kind of makes you want to take a nap. Mm. And not because they're boring, but just because they feel like a safe space.
Mm.
They invite you to borrow that steadiness or that calm. And in a family system, that dance has really deep grooves. One person in a family member's anxiety, like if they have anxiety, can ripple through the room like static. Like another person who might be calm or has a calm presence can lower everyone's shoulders without a single word. If your dad's tension always filled the house, your body might have learned to tighten and sink. And if your mom's silence meant maybe danger, your body still listens for that. These little patterns live in our fascia and our heartbeat and in our breath. So when you return home, and not necessarily the house you grew up in, but like, I don't know, just somewhere where your whole family is going to be, your system automatically tunes to the old frequency. That's why your meditation practice or your asana practice or your mantra practice might crumble faster around family than anywhere else, because you're not just regulating your nervous system. You're swimming in the whole family's emotional current. It's like just a river of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not weakness. It's actually just biology. And humans are social mammals whose sense of safety really depends on collective tone. And I think about that a lot. I'm not really sure. As I say this, someone might be like, oh, well, what's your advice for setting collective tone? As someone who sets collective tone every single day, I've yet to figure out how to set collective tone when it comes to my family. And I think that's one of the things that I find so mesmerizing about this topic.
Mm.
Because I'm really good at setting collective tone, like mm-hmm. when it's anyone but my family. In fact, I'm actually really good with your family. When your parents are around, I can totally set collective tone.
For sure. Well, I feel like, again, I'm reminded of that Ram Dass. If you think you're so evolved, go spend a week with your family.
Totally, totally. I'm vulnerable in sharing that because I don't ever want this podcast to make it seem like either one of us have it all figured out. I'm definitely opening these conversations for myself and also for our community as a whole, like, because none of us have it figured out. And I choose to laugh about it. That's why I'm laughing. Like, oh, Kalina, you set such a great collective tone until you're in a family collective. And then it's like, well, guess not, you know? Actually, you do pretty good at setting collective tone with my family. So maybe that's why, like, having a partner to balance things out is good.
Well, definitely, yeah.
But I do think that yoga gives us tools to change that tone from the inside out. And I do think there have things that have changed over the years with my family because I choose to be different in certain situations. And when I steady my breath, I definitely can signal safety to myself and also to everyone around me. And I think that that's why students of yoga have practiced for centuries through pranayama and meditation, cultivating inner stillness so that radiates outward. It's not just performative calm, not the fake smile at dinner, but an embodied coherence. You regulate yourself in the field shifts. It's energetic in the best kind of way. In practice, it can be really, really simple. When tension builds, for example, you can extend your exhale. One of the things I do with both my parents is like keep my eyes soft, my gaze soft. It tells the brain that the environment is safe, because I tend to be someone who kind of opens my eyes like really large so that I can like see the whole situation. But if I soften my gaze a little bit, I'm able to feel a little bit more grounded. I always offer to drive when I'm with my parents and with your parents. Mm-hmm. I like to feel my feet on the ground, at least one foot on the ground and like one on the pedal, to feel the floor supporting me even when emotions swirl. Because for whatever reason, the car is a place where people love to share things.
Totally.
It happens every single time. It'll be something like, wow, you could have told me that at dinner, but no, you tell me while you're in the back seat.
I remember my mom telling me once, she read in some parenting magazine or something, that like, if you want your teenager to share, you should go for a drive. Something about psychologically about the changing scenery.
I think there's a little truth in that with all of us, because I think back to like all of our road trips, that tends to be when we have the grand catch up, I'll call it. Like, even though we spend a lot of our time together, I still feel like I learn something about you every time that we go on a road trip.
Yeah, likewise.
I think that's why we both like road trips so much. I also really do try to listen before responding. I kind of try to let silence be the bridge when I'm talking to family. pause before I say anything. I've gotten a lot better about that as I've gotten older. And to remind yourself that regulation doesn't mean suppressing your feelings. It means holding emotion without letting it take the whole stage or take over a situation. You become the still lake that can reflect the storm without becoming it. And to be honest with you, and I would be remiss if I didn't say this, people might get really mad that you're calm, especially if that's not the way you've always been. And so there's going to be that too. I want you to brace yourself. The new you might not be met with glee.
With fireworks, yeah.
For sure. But what I will say is when one person in a family begins to regulate, it offers the group a new possibility. And that pattern doesn't have to repeat. You can become the interruption, if you will, not through preaching, but through presence. And I think that Gabe and I do that a lot with both of our families. We're definitely a big ripple in the pond, from the way we dress, from the way we live our lives, to the jobs we hold. Mm-hmm. And even having this podcast, and I think being vulnerable and sharing. I think in yogic terms, this is called seva. Seva is service on a subtle level. It's important to remember that it's not your job to save anyone. Simply offering steadiness as a shared resource. Your calm doesn't make you superior. It just makes you available for whatever's going on. And every time you make yourself available, every time you do it, you rewrite the nervous system story that you perhaps inherited. So as the holidays approach, you know, remember, you don't have to control the room. You just have to hold your own center, to breathe and to soften and stay in your body. And that energy will ripple further than any advice or correction or a deep sigh I ever could. I do want to point out that I know that repair is rare, but it is possible. You can't change your family, but you can change the energy that you bring into it. And most of us didn't grow up in families that maybe modeled emotional repair. I don't want to speak for everyone because that's not fair, but I think many of us may have learned how to rupture, how to fight, or with how to withdraw or get defensive, or maybe even pretend like nothing happened. But not how to return. And I know we spoke a little bit about that when we talked about repair in one of our earlier episodes. In many homes, silence might have been an apology. And time passing was the fix, or you move on, but the residue stays. And without repair, our bodies learn to brace for the next rupture instead of relaxing into connection. We might stay guarded or hypervigilant or self-blaming, and we start believing closeness is unsafe because it's always going to come with pain. That belief, more than any single argument, becomes the barrier to peace, and more specifically, our own peace. I seriously do believe that repair is possible, and when it happens, it's profoundly regulating. And again, repair doesn't mean to pretend like something didn't happen. It just means acknowledging the space between us and choosing to bridge it. It's that moment someone says, hey, that didn't feel good. Can we try again? Or even just, I see you, I still care. In yogic philosophy, this act of coming back is yoga itself, that union, to yoke or to join. Repair is yoga in action, the courage to rejoin what fear might have separated. And I think the hardest part is that someone has to go first. And as the person who typically goes first, I will tell you it never gets easier, but it definitely is worth it. And often the person who has done the most inner work is the one who sees the path back. And that doesn't mean taking all the responsibility. It means leading with a little bit more awareness. Like, you can offer the tone of safety without erasing your own truth. And you can extend a hand without abandoning your own boundary. And conflict doesn't have to equal danger. Disconnection doesn't have to mean the end. The body can discover and survive in honesty and even tenderness and return to peace. And sometimes repair happens through words and sometimes through small gestures, like a touch on the arm, a shared laugh, or unexpected kindness. And sometimes through silence that finally feels safe again. It doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to be real. The yoga of repair invites us to stay open even after we've been hurt. Not naively, but bravely. It asks to hold both truths. What happened mattered, and connection still matters too. Connection will always matter. And that's how yoga moves through families, not by making everyone enlightened per se, but by making one person steady enough to start the repair. And sometimes that's just with themselves. So I'll be honest, I'm a little nervous. My sister's getting married this weekend and I'm flying out tonight. And even though I've been talking for the past hour about nervous systems and yoga and regulation, my stomach can get a little tight. Sometimes it's just because I don't particularly like flying. My breath may be a little short and I keep having flashes of all the ways that this weekend could go completely sideways. Weddings have the way of gathering everything. And not just with my family, I think with everyone's family.
For sure.
Love, grief, unspoken history, all under one cabin. And so you can almost feel the old family stories humming beneath the music. Who sits next to whom? Like, who's drinking too much? Who says the wrong thing at the wrong time? And it's like every role we've ever played comes back for an encore. Part of me wants to, like, armor up, like, wants to suit up and plan all my exits. And to keep my heart a little guarded just in case the energy gets messy. But another part of me, the part that's been practicing yoga for a really long time now, knows that this is the work. And to walk with awareness, not protection, maybe to let even this episode be the first step towards maybe reacting differently in breathing, and to let the body feel what it feels, the contraction, the nerves, the love, all the tangle together, and to stay present anyway. Because calm isn't about being untouched by life. It's about being touched deeply and still staying rooted in yourself. And it's about remembering that you're your own home, no matter where you are or who's in the room. And family will always press those buttons. They're the ones who put the buttons there. They're going to push them. They know where they're at. It's almost like they built the machine. But that doesn't mean that you're powerless. It just means that you get another chance to practice, to notice, to soften, and to maybe even repair what once felt unrepairable. So this week, as I unpack my khaki-colored dress that my sisters requested that I wear, and I do a few practices on my own, and I try to bring as much of my sense of humor as possible, I'm reminding myself I don't have to manage anyone else's energy. I just have to tend to my own, to bring presence, not perfection, and to remember that I'm not the same person who learned those patterns. I'm the one who's witnessing them now. And that maybe more than anything, I can be a walking embodiment of yoga, union, not as harmony, but as wholeness, being human in the middle of all of the potential madness. Because no matter what happens at the wedding or after the wedding or before the wedding, no matter what words fly or tears fall, I can keep coming back to my own mat inside of my own body. And that, I think, is the real practice. I think for the community at large who listens to the podcast, as we move into spooky season and Thanksgiving and Christmas and Hanukkah, we just want to be here to remind you, or I want to be here to remind you, that you're not alone in this world. And then family gatherings feel tender or complicated or downright chaotic, that doesn't mean that you failed at being calm or that your yoga isn't working. It just means you're human and that you care a lot. And take your practice with you, not in the form of perfect stillness, but in the small moments, a deep breath before you speak, a soft gaze when you want to roll your eyes, a step outside to feel your feet on the ground or the earth. And remember that your yoga is alive in those pauses. It's the way you return to yourself again and again, no matter what's happening around you. And when you feel like you don't have time for yoga, like at the studio is exactly when you need to be at the studio. And I know so many of you are so tired of hearing me say that, but it's so true. So from our hearts to yours, we hope that this holiday season is full of miracles, maybe surprising laughter and like little tiny moments of peace that sneak up when you least expect them. We're grateful that you're here. We're grateful that you're listening and breathing and learning with us. So take care of yourself, take care of your heart, and let's take care of one another. And if things get wild at the dinner table, just know we're right there with you, breathing too. And thank you, friends, and we'll see you in the next episode of Bigger Than Love.
Yes, we shall.
Three peace.